My name is Stephen Bigelow, features writer with Tough Targets Storage Media Group, and I'm speaking with Pierre Dorian, disaster recovery expert and senior business continuity consultant with Mainland Information Systems Incorporated out of Phoenix, Arizona. Pierre, thanks so much for joining us today to discuss disaster recovery.
Well, thank you.
Pierre, there are lots of questions surrounding disaster recovery and its impact on business operations, so let's go through some of the most frequent questions that you encounter. And it probably makes the most sense to start with, are tape backups a thing of the past when it comes to disaster recovery?
And that's an excellent question. It comes up very often, actually. So I guess we have to look at disaster recovery when it comes to tapes in order of priority. So if we're talking about your most critical applications nowadays, your most critical data, tape backup is actually losing favor to disk backup or data replication. That said, we always have to keep in mind that not all data is created equal and is not as critical as others. So tape still has a very good place in the DR scheme of things just because of its low cost and ease of portability, if you will, to send it off-site. So I would not consider it a thing of the past just yet. Still very useful. That said, because of its performance and also at times the ability to acquire the tape rapidly, it's more suited for lower criticality or lower priority applications or data that still have to be recovered in the event of a site-wide disaster. So I would say they're still very current, and until we find cheap disk, they're still very much in fashion.
Excellent. And another question that seems to come up quite a bit, Pierre, is some confusion between disk backup and data replication. What is the difference between disk backup and data replication?
Yes, it's a good question. The term has been used, or the terms have been used interchangeably quite a bit lately because of the popularity of disk backup that is really gaining. The thing is disk backup is another form, or technically or theoretically, another form of media that your backup application or solution can write to, as where data replication technically should be an exact replica, as the name implies, of your data. The main difference here is, one, data replication can be acquired as a volume and immediately or almost immediately accessed by the application. So it is written in a format that is understood by your database or your email server or whatever it is, as where if you back up to disk, it will be written to a disk device in a format that is understood by the backup application. Therefore, you need to restore the data that was backed up to disk, typically, to be able to access it. So that would be the main distinction here, and not to be confused, because one is almost immediately accessible, which is almost like a mirror or a snapshot or another copy of your data. That's replication, as where the backup is written in a format, for example, TAR or whatever specific format your backup application uses. It implies a restore operation before the data can be accessed. That's a very important distinction. Because now, if we're talking about disk backup, we're talking about faster backup than tape, but not faster restore than data replication. Data replication, as I said before, almost allows you to do instant recovery of your data. So very, very specific distinction between the two here.
Excellent. Pierre, there is a lot of discussion in terms of disaster recovery site locations. How far apart should a production site be from a recovery site?
And as a good consultant, I would have to use the typical answer, it depends. what we have here is there's a few things to consider. What kind of disaster are you trying to protect yourself from or your organization? But more predominantly, what geography are you in? If you are along the Florida coast, chances are you should be quite far from your production site because of hurricanes, as we saw, in fact, last year. It was pretty devastating in New Orleans and Alabama and Florida. So, of course, your 10 miles or 20 miles will definitely not be sufficient in those areas. Conversely, if you're in Texas, for example, and trying to protect yourself from tornadoes, well, as we know, tornadoes are very, very narrow. It's really a path. So then the distance could be lesser. What we've seen in recent surveys that were done from a DR perspective in the industry, we've seen an average of about 30 miles. There was an effort from the SEC to try to impose a standard. They quickly abandoned just because of that very specific fact of the geography and what you're really trying to protect your data from or your data center. It also depends on criticality and potential losses. If you are losing millions of dollars because your data is not acceptable, then it may be acceptable to be far away and spend that kind of money. Conversely, if you're not losing as much, it's always a question of balancing your losses with the cost of protecting your assets. So it may not be financially feasible to be very, very far away, such as halfway across the country. So we need to measure the losses versus the risk and the value of the data and the cost of solution. Another factor to consider also is the latency or the rate at which transactions or I/O has to be replicated from one place to another. So if you're replicating data, for example, from a production site to a remote site, you need to make sure that data makes it there on time, especially if it's very far away. There may be latency here that may not be acceptable to your business. So there's a lot of factors to consider before a decision like that is made. So again, going back to the original answer, as you can see, it really depends. There's a lot of factors to examine here.
So it sounds like one size doesn't fit all when you're considering an alternate site.
That's correct. That's correct. That requires quite a bit of thinking and planning. And beyond just an IT perspective, we really need to look at the business side of things, your requirements, and potentially regulatory compliance requirements as well.
And I think that leads into another question, Pierre. An organization can have a substantial amount of data that it's responsible for. How do you identify what data to replicate and what data to simply back up?
Yeah, and that leads right out of the previous question into this one. When you're looking at replication solutions, it goes back again to the value of the data to your organization, or the impact of losing this data or access to this data. So typically, from a business continuity perspective, the best way to establish this is through what we call a business impact analysis, which really measures the impact on your revenue stream or your organization from a public point of view. Public perception, the impact of an outage or disruption, business disruption. And that really dictates, you need to start from the business processes and look at what applications these business processes depend on, and then you move down the chain. Once you've identified the applications and the dependencies, you can start looking at the data that these applications use. And that's how you categorize the data based on the business processes that use that data and the importance of those business processes to the organization from a revenue perspective. And we always have to make the distinction. There's what we call a qualitative and a quantitative impact. Quantitative is fairly easy to measure. It's a dollar value. But a qualitative impact is really from a public perception, loss of confidence in your company, your brand. For example, if you can't do banking for a few hours online, that may cause a bank to lose a few customers. So the impact of an outage was not necessarily measured at that point in dollars, but eventually will transpire into dollars. So that's what we call a qualitative impact. So really, that's what drives the value of data, and in the end, helps you identify and categorize the data to decide what should you replicate. So you're most critical for going back to the previous question on replication versus backups. This is where you start setting things apart, and this is where you can also start into moving into storage tiers.
Excellent. Excellent. And I think that also segues into another very important question, Pia, and that is a question of priority. Clearly not every application has the same priority in an organization, so how do you go about establishing a recovery priority for your applications?
And really, this question and the previous one go hand in hand, and it's really one and the same thing. The question comes up differently. Sometimes it's from, if it's at the IT level, it comes from a data perspective. When you start moving up a little bit into the business side, people start looking at the applications because they don't really know where the data is. And if we talk today about virtualization, you kind of lose where that data is, so you're looking at the application. But it's really essentially the same idea. The recovery priority for your applications is based on the same criteria as the actual value of the data they use. It's really which business processes make use of those applications, and based on the criticality. And the priority itself really goes to dependencies as well. For example, very simple concept here, DNS, which could be considered an application or utility, depending on how you look at it, could have a higher priority than some other systems, because if you don't have DNS, you don't have response on your internet connections or your network connections. So obviously dependencies are also very important. It's not necessarily at this point a dollar value. It becomes a technical question. Active Directory, authentication, and all these security applications, of course, now at this point move up in the food chain in terms of priority, and they need to be restored before anything else can be restored. And something that's very often overlooked is the backup application itself. It's probably one of the most critical applications that you have, although it doesn't show up as an application most of the time. It becomes an infrastructure component. You need to restore your backup server and your backup application before you can start restoring data.
Right, right. So it also sounds like a priority is set uniquely depending on each business's own needs. One organization may have a complete reliance on one application, and without it, they're out of business. So that would take a much higher priority than the same application in another business that may not use it as much.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it becomes, that's where it differentiates itself a little bit from the previous question when we're talking about data replication. Priority is really based on an order of things and dependencies. When we look at a business, there's always core functions and support functions. Backups are definitely a support function. The core function may be the banking industry. So from a data replication and criticality of the data, it's definitely the financial data that would be important and the most critical. However, when we're looking at an application priority, we need to start looking at support functions and core functions.
Excellent. Pia, next question. Backups and archives seem to come up a lot in conversation, and there seems to be a question of their relationship. Aren't backups and archives essentially the same thing, or is there a difference between them?
And the answer to that could be a yes and no. If we look at a very high level, a copy of data is a copy of data, and that's where a lot of people make this maybe they confuse both as being somewhat the same, one is just kept longer. When we start digging into what a backup is for and what an archive is for, that's when we really start seeing the distinction here. A backup is really a copy of a file to protect yourself against data loss should something happen. So it's always a much more immediate need. Where an archive is really a copy of certain records that could be completely taken out of context of their initial environment or structure, and that are kept for future reference, not for recovery purposes. For an example of that is if you have a database, a customer database, there's all kinds of records in there. Some of the records date back from 1999. Chances are you don't really need those records to do your everyday business. This is something that you keep for whatever reason. There's a possibility here to archive part of this, yet you still back up your database every day in case something happens, because you need to access these records immediately. So there's a very specific distinction in between the two, and archives should not be used or considered to be used for DR purposes. Really, a backup is what counts. You would restore from your backups, but you don't necessarily retrieve your archives following a disaster. This data is far away, kept somewhere, safe, in case you need it, not for recovery purposes.
Excellent. Pierre, another consideration that comes up is the role of operating system files. Should I back up the operating system files along with my data?
Yeah, that's a question that comes up very frequently, and it's a problem today. We hear a lot about single-instance storage, single-instance backup. When you start backing up operating system files, you will have the same DLL, for example, on each of your Windows servers. You may have 100 servers. Should you back that up? I would say if you have a small environment, I wouldn't worry too much about it, but once you start growing into a larger environment, you probably should not back up operating system files. That said, that should be protected. So we have products like ghosting products. We have products that allow you to virtualize some of your servers, for example, VMware, where you can create a live copy of your system living somewhere else. If you have infrastructure that supports the ability to deploy standby servers somewhere else, all these instances allow you to not back up your operating system files. You don't want to have to do this. You want to back up, however, your system objects, such as for Windows registries, because there's a lot of settings in there that you don't want to reapply. But as far as the operating system files, the ones that are installed, I would say get some system images that are updated frequently as your operating system changes, and keep that out of your backup loop. Your backups should really protect your dynamic application data and not the operating system files. You can have terabytes and terabytes of data that is stored on tape, and when you try to restore your systems, typically you're not going to restore that. You're going to rebuild an operating system and then restore your data. So why did you back up these files in the first place? I typically recommend against backing them up, but do cover the system objects, which are very specific to configuration information on each system.
That's a great insight, PR. And another question that seems to crop up very frequently is, what's the difference between RPO and RTO from a backup perspective?
Yeah, so the recovery point objective for RPO and the recovery time objective, there are two very specific settings or parameters, should I say, that are closely associated with recovery. The recovery time objective is how long you can basically go without a specific application. This is often associated with your maximum allowable or maximum tolerable outage. This is how long I expect. My objective is to recover the system within X amount of time. And that's what really is used to dictate whether you will replicate data, backup to tape or backup to disk, is your recovery time objective. And that also dictates what you will put together for an infrastructure, whether it's a high availability cluster for seamless failover. If your recovery time objective is zero, in other words, I cannot go down, while you go down the route of having a completely redundant infrastructure with replicated data offsite, so on and so forth. If your recovery time objective is 48 hours, 72 hours, then maybe tape backups is okay for that specific application. That's the recovery time objective. The recovery point objective is slightly different. This dictates the allowable data loss. How much data can I afford to lose? In other words, if I do a nightly backup at 7 o'clock at night, and my system goes up in flames at 4 o'clock in the afternoon the following day, everything that was changed since my last backup is lost. My recovery point objective in this particular context, if that's acceptable, is the previous day's backup. If I'm a company that does online transaction processing, people buying merchandise online, if I'm American Express, for example, well, maybe my recovery point objective is down to the latest transaction, the latest bit of information that came in. Again, that dictates the kind of data protection solution you want in place. So both of them, RTO and RPO, really influence the kind of redundancy or backup infrastructure you will put together. The tighter the RTO and the tighter the RPO, the more money you're going to spend on your infrastructure.
Absolutely. And tape still seems to be in common use, and it's often sent to off-site storage facilities. What is considered best practice in terms of backup vaulting frequency?
Yeah, and as a consultant, this is something I run into myself very often. There seems to be a belief that if you're a smaller shop, smaller business, you don't have a lot of data, that you don't need to send your data all that often off-site. And a lot of times it's dictated, unfortunately, by the growing capacity of tape media. It becomes almost embarrassing to send a tape volume that has a capacity of 400 gigabytes native, for example, LTO3, without considering compression. If you're backing up 100 gigabytes a week, it becomes embarrassing to a lot of folks to send that off-site because it's not full. So a lot of companies have a tendency to want to fill that tape before they send it off-site, which is a big, big mistake. What we typically say is it doesn't matter how big or small the organization is, there is a requirement to protect your data that is equal. Because you're a smaller company doesn't mean you can afford to go out of business. But unfortunately, there's perception that tapes have to be filled up. So from our perspective, we always say the best practice is daily. But then again, this is closely tied with your recovery point objective that we just talked about a moment ago. If your recovery point objective is 24 hours, up to 24 hours, meaning that I can afford to lose up to 24 hours worth of data, but no more, well, people say, I'll back up every day and I'm okay. Well, that's true only if you send your tapes off-site every day. Because you back up every night, and if you send your tapes off-site every week, you can lose up to a week's worth of data. And that's a perception that is, people don't necessarily think about that. They think they're backing up every night, it's good, they're protected. But should something happen to your entire data center, all of a sudden, your nightly backup is irrelevant because your tapes were sent off-site weekly. Now you're stuck recovering last week's backups that were sent off-site. And can you recreate this data? Maybe, maybe not. It again ties back into criticality of the data, potential losses. So if you stand to lose a lot of money because you lost a week's worth of data, well, maybe it was worth buying more tapes and sending these tapes off-site daily as opposed to weekly. So that's a very important concept that a lot of companies seem to sometimes mix up. And by the way, you should never send your original copy, or your, I shouldn't say original, but your unique copy off-site. That's another mistake. If you back up and you do not create a copy of that backup and you send that off-site, well, it's almost as bad as keeping it on-site. The problem is here we have a single copy. Best practices would dictate that you keep a copy on-site for quick access, for quicker recovery, and you send a copy off-site for disaster recovery purposes. So you should always have two copies of your tape, one on-site and one sent off-site daily. That's really best practices from that perspective. Again, keeping in mind cost, always looking at what the potential losses are and then justify whether you should do it daily or not. Technically, with the cost of tapes today, I don't think it's worth neglecting. The process is not that expensive that you should send your tapes off-site weekly. Another important point in when it comes to best practices with respect to tape and vaulting is the storage conditions. The trunk of your car is not a good vault, especially if you live in Phoenix. But it's 115 degrees. Your tapes may not be recoverable or readable. So that's another important aspect, the storage conditions of your media. A lot of companies, in an effort to save money, will try to store the tapes maybe to another location they have. And sometimes it's also a security concern because they don't want the tapes to be in someone else's hands, or they're afraid the tapes may be lost. So they try to develop the process in-house. You know, nothing wrong with that as long as the storage conditions at the other location are optimal in terms of temperature, relative humidity, and really based on the tape manufacturer's recommendation.
Excellent. Well, Peter, those are some terrific insights.
Thank you.
Recovery and recovery time is always a serious concern for anyone doing disaster recovery work. And how can I improve recovery time for email and file servers without spending a fortune on remote data replication?
Yeah, that's a growing concern in the industry today because what we've seen, we've seen data explosion or data growth explosion. We're looking at 50, 60% in a lot of cases and more in other cases of growth on a yearly basis. The file servers are getting huge. Mail servers are becoming just impossible to manage or to restore. And a lot of that is caused by there's a little bit of fear of making an actual decision with respect to the data because of all these compliance issues. We're afraid to delete data now because that may get us in trouble. So we've seen these servers grow to become enormous, yet because we can't restore them. I mean, I've seen instances where a file server took 72 and even more hours to be restored. In some cases, that's completely unacceptable from a recovery time objective perspective. So the first thing that comes to mind is, well, we'll have to replicate all that data and have a standby file server ready to come up should something happen. Well, if that's what you can afford and what you need, that's fine. But if you can't afford to spend that kind of money yet need access to your data, there are other ways. Today, there's a number of solutions out there that allow you to make your mail servers and your file servers a lot leaner from a data perspective. And I'm talking about archiving solutions here. For example, Enterprise Vault from Symantec, if it's okay to name names, is a fine example of that, where you can actually take some attachments or some actual email messages or some files on a file server and move them to another type of storage, a lower cost storage, or potentially a storage that you will not restore immediately should something happen. So what we're looking at here is an opportunity to reduce the size of your mail server, for example, your information store if you're using Exchange, to reduce it to a size that is easy to back up, easy to restore, and that contains really what you need to access on a daily basis. We rarely go back and look at email that came in 6 months ago unless we really have to. This is not something we work with on a daily basis. Same thing with files on a file server. We've become pack rats when it comes to data, and all you have to do for that is look at your home system, your personal system, and it's not uncommon to see files that have a timestamp of 1998, and you go look at that, and you go, oh, Lord, what was this? So this is very common, and that's what we do. We pack millions of files. So again, same idea. If we don't use a lot of this data, we archive it using one of those solutions to another media, to another type of media. We can send that off-site. We can have it on-site. We can back it up maybe once a month or once a week for that portion of the data, and we only keep on our servers, mail servers, file servers, what we need to do business on a daily basis. And what the beauty about a lot of these solutions is it's a little bit like HSM, Hierarchical Storage Management, where it moves the bulk of the data to another location, but it leaves a little pointer in your email program or on your fail server. So from a user perspective, everything is still there. They look at it, they see it, if they click on it, it may take a little longer to come up, but the file, as far as they're concerned, is still there. So you're not hiding that data, really. You're just putting it somewhere else, and you're leaving a bit of a shortcut. That allows your file servers to be much leaner, and same with your mail servers, and of course, it really enhances the recoverability. Now you can back them up in a nightly cycle, and you can restore these servers within a reasonable time frame, which is now becoming more and more difficult for most organizations that have, you know, multi-terabyte file servers. And besides that, what we're starting to see with a lot of overblown file servers and mail servers is we have corruption problems that creep up every now and then. Very difficult to control, and performance problems on our system. So again, another advantage with this here is a leaner, meaner system, really. That's what it is.
Outstanding. Outstanding. And one thing that I noted in your answer, Pierre, is your mention of different levels of storage. And I think that ties into another very important question. What do tiered storage and ILM have to do with disaster recovery?
Absolutely. And that all ties back into the same topic of data growth and data control and data management and recoverability. Tiered storage, as we talked about a little earlier here in the previous questions, once you start categorizing your data based on criticality and recovery priority, well, right away that dictates the type of, I shouldn't say dictate, but it gives you an indication of data segments. We have our high priority data, we have our medium criticality data, and we have our low criticality or low restore priority data. This is a perfect opportunity if you're looking into doing tiered storage to start dividing your data or using those categories to store your data. From a cost perspective, if your data is highly critical to your organization and you want to replicate it because it's so critical, you can't afford downtime, well, that probably belongs on your highest performance, most redundant storage array. Conversely, if you have data that can wait because it's really no rush to restore it, well, then maybe that belongs on your lowest tier or your lowest cost storage, or even potentially, as we talked about archival solutions, on tape somewhere and only accessed if you need to. So tiered storage here, it's also a way to decide what do we restore first, what do we bring up first, what do we rebuild first. It's not just a question of cost at this time. It can be tied right back into DR and used as a their containers, and of course your highest criticality data should be recovered first, so therefore you concentrate on rebuilding or maybe making your high tier more redundant. And then when we look at ILM, well, ILM ties right back into all this. Information lifecycle management or data lifecycle management is, again, all about categorizing the data based on its criticality or potentially some legal requirements, but again, ties very closely into tiered storage or data tiers. Do you keep your outgoing data on your top tier? Probably not. If the data is reaching the end of its life cycle, it should probably be moved to a media, a storage media of lesser cost and lesser performance, because at this point we're just keeping it for potentially legal reasons. And again, tying back into disaster recovery, we're probably not going to restore that data immediately following a disaster. So information lifecycle management is the categorization that we talked about before. All of this is what helps you identify and put the data into segments or clusters or containers based on criticality or value to the organization or legal implications. So all this, and by the way, I have something coming up soon that I'm working on, a little piece that I'm writing specifically around data, keeping data for a long time and the cost of cheap storage in relation to that, the declining cost of storage, having provided an opportunity for companies to avoid doing ILM for a long time. Because storage is so cheap, why make a decision, let's just store everything? Now, from a recoverability perspective, we're seeing problems around that. You did not want to make a decision about your data, you just wanted to keep it all. But now, when comes the time to restore it, you don't know what to restore first because you never really did a categorization exercise based on criticality and whatnot. So ILM is now becoming a very important part of disaster recovery just for the purpose of knowing what you should restore first.
Excellent. Excellent. Again, a lot of great information for our listeners, Pierre. And taken all together, Pierre, with all of the terrific information that you've covered for us, what is the most important aspect of data protection when it comes to disaster recovery?
I would have to answer, you could answer that with one word, really, and I would have to say test. Just test. Whatever you do when you're protecting data, whether it's a backup, whether it's replication, whatever it is, make sure that you test whatever it is you put in place. Because the vendor's glossies said that this allows you to restore virtually in seconds, I wouldn't necessarily take their word for it. And it's a question of knowing, being prepared. When we talk about disaster recovery planning, well, that's where the planning comes into play. You have all this beautiful technology, you have all these storage tiers, you have these recovery schemes, you've done everything the right way, but unless you test all of this, and I'm not saying once, I'm saying on a regular basis, unless you do this constantly, you will always be at risk that whatever you invested money on to protect your infrastructure and, most importantly, your data, you always run the risk that it will not work when you need it the most. Again, if we're talking about very, very tight recovery time objectives, testing is so important because you may miss that recovery time objective. You may miss that window because you did not test. And it's not always because things don't work. It's just because you didn't take the time to familiarize yourself with the procedure. I've seen a regrettable incident at one point where a database was being replicated, and the production database became corrupt. and because of a planning glitch, poor documentation, human error, the corrupted copy of the database was restored over the good copy as opposed to the other way around. Now we ended up with two corrupted database copies. So again, it goes to show documentation, planning, and of course testing, making sure that all of this works is really, really important. So whenever you talk data protection, whether it's tape backups or data replication, it's all about testing. Many times you will ask clients when you walk into an environment, how are your backups? Oh, our backups are fine. Run every night, successful completion every night. The next question usually is, did you try restoring from all this? Well, we do the occasional file restore, and that's very common. So test, test, test. That's my answer to that.
Terrific. Well, Pierre, I think that wraps it up for today's question and answer session. I want to thank our disaster recovery expert and frequent search storage contributor, Pierre Dorion, for sharing his insights and expertise with us today. Pierre, thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And I'm Stephen Bigelow, features writer for TechTarget Storage Media Group, and you can learn more about storage and disaster recovery at www.searchstorage.com.